Welcome to Now You Know Politics. I'm Catherine Sussman.
And I'm Rob Laidlaw.
Today, we will be discussing the ethics of what are often described as roadside zoos, privately owned, smaller facilities than the larger governmentally run zoos. These places often present themselves as sanctuaries, but in fact keep animals in inadequate conditions, sometimes having them perform circus-like tricks or even allowing visitors to get dangerously close to the animals. Join us as we discuss some of the current facilities here in Canada and efforts to stop them, such as a big cat facility that was set to open in Grand Bend, Ontario, plans for a bear facility set to open in Kearney, Ontario, and the recently shut down St. Edward Zoo in Quebec. This episode will enable you to identify zoo techniques and practices that can mislead visitors into thinking facilities are better than they are. Thanks for listening. Hi, Rob. How are you today?
Not too bad.
Great to talk to you. So our show today is going to be talking about the difference between a zoo and a sanctuary and how, just in general, how zoos really are not all the same. So as I like to say to people, a zoo is not a zoo is not a zoo, which might be a quote that I have stolen from you. It's possible. But could we just start off by having your ideas on the distinction between a zoo, a sanctuary, and a roadside zoo?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's a subject that's sort of dear to my heart because I've been involved in the whole world of zoos, both in Canada and elsewhere around the world for so many decades. But to me, I should preface my comments by saying that I don't endorse the sort of menagerie-style zoo concept that is the way that most zoos are formatted today. I think it's basically a failed concept, and that the institutions that are out there today aren't really doing what people think they're doing. So having gotten that out of the way, yes, there is a continuum, and it ranges from, you know, the large professional institutions that have permanent staff. They may have university-educated curatorial staff, veterinarians, all those kinds of people, as well as, you know, administrative staff that are professional in terms of the administrative functions and fundraising and all of those things. So you've got those big ones, and those are the zoos that most people know. Here in Canada, you'd probably think of the Toronto Zoo or the Montreal Biodome or the Calgary Zoo as being examples of that kind of zoo. But, you know, as you move towards the other end of the continuum, you find that there's a large number of other kinds of zoos, some of them that I think are actually better than the more famous zoos. So you have some regional zoos like Salmonier Nature Park in Newfoundland that houses only native species, and they do a pretty good job at replicating the natural environment of the species that they keep.
I've been there, Rob. I took my daughter there 2 summers ago. It was beautiful.
Yeah. So, you know, you do have zoos that are sort of those mid-level zoos. And in the United States, you have a lot of sort of the smaller urban zoos that are usually older zoos that, you know, back in the 50s and 60s, when every city and town wanted a zoo, they built the zoo right in the city. So you have still a lot of those. But then when you move even further down the continuum, you find the roadside zoos, and they're generally sort of the mom and pop type of operations. They're privately owned. They have minimal funding. Often the caging, care, and the management of animals is at a very minimal level or even below what should be a minimal level. And certainly in the past, they were the bulk of the problem when you looked at zoos in North America. Generally speaking, what people would notice the most about roadside zoos is they're just not at a professional level. The cages and enclosures are pretty rudimentary, usually small, and there will be manifestations of minimal levels of care and management pretty much anyone could see.
What's really interesting is that when I was a kid, I've always loved animals. When I was a kid, I used to love to go to what I now see are roadside zoos, because as a young child, I found them exciting because you could get much closer to the animals. I remember Jungle Cat World. I always bring this one up because I loved, you know, big cats. And I thought, wow, this was a totally different experience than the Toronto Zoo. I was really able to get right up close and personal, sometimes even pet. I think at the Peterborough Zoo, even as a child, I was able to pet a tiger cub that they were walking around, or lion cub that they were walking around the zoo. Yeah, so there was that element, and it is precisely for the reasons you're describing why that's such a bad idea. But to young kids, it can seem like a lot of fun.
Well, and certainly you do see that in many of the smaller zoos. They're unregulated, certainly here in Ontario, but they're subject to only minimal levels of regulation in many other areas, including in the United States. So you see them trying to engage the public in ways that the more professional zoos won't. So a lot of that can involve animal contact, and often in situations where the animals are potentially dangerous and the contact therefore is potentially dangerous to members of the public who usually assume everything's okay.
So I thought we could start off today, because NYK politics is really rooted in discussing current events in the news. I thought we could start off by talking about something you've just been a big part of stopping, which is this big cat sanctuary that was set to be built on Grand Bend.
Yeah, it's being called the Roaring Cat Retreat. And right now, the municipality, which is Lambton Shores, is in a bit of a battle with the proprietor of this place. His name's Mark Drysdale. And he had moved some cats in. He was, for all intents and purposes, forced out of his previous location. He ran something called Ringtail Ranch in the town of Waynefleet down near Niagara Falls. So he was forced to move out of there, and he ended up in Grand Bend, which is a small town, sort of a touristy town.
It was interesting because I was reading a couple of articles on this big cat sanctuary that now is no longer going to happen. But it's funny because when Drysdale was being interviewed, and this is a quote, he admits he has no formal education when it comes to animals. And then there's a quote, "They're just babies," he said. "They really are. They act like little sucks. That's not to say they're not predators. Things do go wrong." But it's just this like kind of egregious misunderstanding of how dangerous wild big cats, wild animals, can be.
Yes, and you know, it's fine for somebody who may be a custodian of these animals or own these animals to accept the risk of dealing with them. That's their choice. They can make that choice. But where it becomes problematic is when members of the public who don't know otherwise are then exposed to the animals. They believe that those animals are safe when they're not, and they put themselves at risk. So it's fine for people who have these animals. You can accept that risk, but you know, you shouldn't ever put other people who don't know in a position of facing that risk as well.
And just for people who don't know, because I have worked on, I've done a bunch of tiger research for ZooCheck for another project, people interacting with big cats. And tigers are the largest and most powerful of the big cats and should always be considered very dangerous. There have been so many attacks of people that privately own animals, even here in Canada, over the years. And when they attack, I mean, the size of the tigers alone, it's crazy. The males can weigh up to 660 pounds. They have prominent canine teeth. They reach incredible speeds. I think it's between 50 and 65 kilometers an hour. I mean, these are just serious apex predators. And even if they look like little pussycats, they can turn on you, and or big pussycats, they can turn on you in a split second. And can just mean the end of your life.
Yeah, and that's important to remember, that it doesn't really matter how they've acted in the past or what they look like or how docile they may seem at a particular point in time. They are large. They are possessing attributes, speed, power, claws, teeth, etc., that make them potentially dangerous. And when attacks do occur, they can occur in an instant, and before anybody can do anything, it's over. And it's interesting to note, when you look at professional zoo associations and you look at legislation around the world that deals with dangerous wild animals, you'll see that they often deal with not only those larger animals, but they classify even small animals, so the smaller spotted cats like lynx and bobcat, as being the highest level of danger, bears being the highest level of danger. There's all kinds of animals that are much smaller and seemingly more innocuous than, you know, tigers that are still considered by professionals and by legislators and policymakers as being exceptionally dangerous and requiring very special kinds of containment and management. So
every major zoological institution, so like the AZA, so the Association of Zoos and Aquariums, the TAG group, the Felid Taxon Advisory Group, the ZAA, GFAS, HSUS, every single major group does not recommend even professional tiger or big cat keepers to be interacting, except if they're like hand rearing very young cubs, unless the animal has been sedated. So it's really interesting that, you know, there should be nobody allowing people, the public, to interact with big cats. That just should not be happening.
And that is exactly why people who are self-taught are potentially dangerous to others, because they haven't been in professional institutions. They haven't been mentored by people who understand these animals. You know, when they're self-taught, you can become very complacent. Your animal may do something. A good example being Norm Gualda down in near London in a municipality. You know, his cat acted the same way probably 1,000 times in a row, and then the 1,001st time it killed them. And there's all kinds of situations like that that have been documented. So, you know, when you are self-taught, you don't have that mentoring, it's not driven into you how dangerous these animals potentially are and how you should handle them. When that's not ingrained into you, it's a very dangerous situation for everybody.
So moving along, I'd really love to talk to you about the Saint-Édouard Zoo in Quebec, because this is all over the news right now. And this really is an extreme example of what can go wrong when somebody takes it upon themselves to run a zoo and does not know how to do that correctly.
Yeah, and certainly there's been a lot of press about the zoo. From what I understand, it was, and I haven't been there, I have to say that I have never been there, but I've heard about it. And it was quite an example of, again, a quintessential roadside zoo type operation. You know, minimal facilities for the animals, minimal care, you know, not a lot of staff. I don't think there were any professionally trained staff. So, you know, all of the things that we've talked about were manifested in this particular facility. And eventually it led to official action. And
well, let's just to give people a sense of what we're talking about here, and I actually have friends that are there right now trying to help deal with the situation with the animals, so I've heard a lot about this firsthand. But I have an article, a Global News article, in front of me. Just read from that for a minute. So these animals were allegedly malnourished, lacked adequate space, water, and veterinary care. And they seized over 100 animals from the zoo and have arrested the owner on charges of criminal animal cruelty and neglect, which I believe it's the first time that criminal charges have been laid. Is that accurate?
Well, there's certainly been provincial charges, but under the federal criminal code, I can't recall any other instances where criminal code charges in this kind of a situation.
Apparently, these animals had no access to water. Again, I'm quoting, their enclosures were sometimes too small, dirty, and dangerous. They were given inappropriate food and deprived of veterinary care.
Yes, and this is not entirely unique to this facility in Canada. There are still other places like that in Canada. And hopefully, you know, they will be dealt with in good time. But if we go and look in the past, you see that there were literally dozens and dozens and dozens of places like that right across Canada. Thank goodness that isn't the situation anymore.
And this owner, it says he admitted himself in an interview by inspectors in October of 2018 that he did not provide heated shelters for animals from warm climates and that most animals had no vet care. He said that when animals were sick, he kept them away from the public or sold them in order to avoid complaints.
Yeah, and again, that's something we've encountered for many years. It's
let me make it a bit worse, and then you can comment. He also admitted to killing a bird by stepping on its stomach and shooting a lion and tiger to death. So I'd love to hear you speak on that. how, you know, is that legal if the intent is not to cause pain under, you know, the criminal code?
My understanding is that in most circumstances, because animals are property, that people can do with their property as they wish. So, you know, an example that frequently comes up amongst animal advocates is dogs. People are, you know, let's say you live on a farm and you don't want your dog, you can take your dog out in the front yard and shoot the dog in the head. And that would be legal. So I don't know why that wouldn't apply as well to other animals, because those other animals would be property as well. Now, you can't starve them. You can't, you know, do what some of these horrendous people do, drag them behind a car until they're dead.
Step on its stomach, maybe that right. wouldn't fly. But if you're shooting, if you could argue that they were old or, you know, there was some reason they were suffering or something.
Exactly. And certainly the culling of zoo animals is not something that most people know about, but it happens a lot. Certainly, you know, most people that follow this stuff know about Marius the giraffe being culled mm-hmm. at the Copenhagen Zoo, but many people are surprised to learn that, hey, it happens here as well. In fact, the Toronto Zoo has done it with some of their stock in past years. Certainly many of the small zoos, we've heard of animals being killed just because there's lack of space, because, you know, babies were born in order to do petting sessions and photos and things like that, and then they would be killed in the fall. We've heard of animals being killed for taxidermy purposes. So, you know, shooting animals, if you're a zoo owner, is not something new to us.
So can you tell us a bit about Ruth LaBarge and her plans for an educational, quote, educational conservation center?
Yeah, this is one that caught us by surprise. It's just very recent. We found out just through a private citizen that heard this at a meeting that there was this proposal for something called the Wild Connections Education Facility. And this Wild Connections would be right in the town of Kearney. And for people that have never heard of Kearney, it's just north of Huntsville, and it's at one of the entrances to Algonquin Park. It's usually canoeists and hikers that go, because the road into the park doesn't go right through the park, so it's sort of an entry point for canoeists and hikers. But anyhow, this proposal was put forward. The town only has 800 people in it, so a very, very small town. And a proponent of the Wild Connections facility is a woman named Ruth LaBarge. And she's one person that has a little bit of a history in that she had spent 14 years out in Alberta at the Discovery Wildlife Park. And during at least some of that time, she would conduct these education sessions. And after the education sessions, and they were about bears. She claims they were about bear safety. And she had her own Kodiak bears and that at the zoo. So she would allow people after the education presentations into the bear cage. And she had one bear particularly, I believe, the bear's name was Alley-Oop, and this was about a 1,400-pound Kodiak bear, brown bear. Wow. She would have people crouch in front of the bear, who was obviously standing behind them, and the bear was separated only by a few strands of hot wire, so very low strands of hot wire. And hot wire just means electrified wire. So the bear would be behind the wire, and the people would be in front of the wire, and they'd have their photo taken with the bear in the back. And now, to me, that was crazy to begin with, because a hot wire barrier, unless it's very robust and built in a very specific kind of way, is not a primary barrier to contain a bear. In fact, you know, a bear can just run right through three strands of hot wire stuck on poles that, you know, if they wanted to get through it, it's no issue at all.
But the footage you sent me, there was no barrier. Was there even a barrier between the bear and those people kissing?
Yes, you probably just didn't notice.
I see.
But it was there, but it's not much of a barrier. And in fact, hot wires, when they're strung up like that, are considered a psychological barrier. They can't physically contain, they couldn't contain a bear. They couldn't contain a wolf or most other creatures that want to get through them. It's a psychological barrier. But anyhow, she also did something that I think was even more surprising to me, and I say surprising because I can't believe anybody would do this. She would have people, members of the public, actually put their hands behind their back and lean over the hot wire and have this huge bear lick their face. I sent it to some bear experts, and you know, one of them just wrote back, "Oh my God, they never believed anyone would ever do something like that." And of course, again, as we mentioned before, and you know, when we were discussing previous topics, the people who are doing this don't know.
They're well-meaning. They love their animals. Often they've reared them from the time they were just babies. So right. They think nothing can go wrong. But the problem right. is, even if you look at the famous example of Siegfried and Roy in Las Vegas, look at those guys. They, if anybody, you know, had a handle on their animals, it was them. And one of them almost ended up dead because of it.
Exactly.
So Ruth LaBarge is no longer doing that kind of thing with the animals. How recent was that footage?
The pictures and the footage from a U.S. program called Inside Edition were from 2005. Now, Ruth LaBarge says, well, you know, my presentation methods have evolved and changed. And, you know, hopefully that's true. I don't know if it is true, but let's just assume it is. But what hasn't changed is the use of bears in various situations, because she provides bears for commercial and television film shoots. And there's, you know, from different sources online, you can get photos of her in 2014, 2015, 2017, still doing that with those three little strands of hot wire. So I would say there's still a problem.
And this just goes to show, yeah, that we have a lot of work to do when it comes to fixing our laws to prevent this sort of thing from happening. I just wanted to end by talking with you a bit about what people can do. I mean, people often say to me, you know, oh, you're such a downer or a bummer, but there's this great new film out and, you know, it's about a kid and a bear and, you know, why aren't you letting your daughter go see it? And I don't like to take my daughter to films that have wild animals in them for this kind of reason, because I started looking into it a bit, and I could be wrong, correct me if I'm wrong, but a lot of the animals used in Hollywood films, or maybe not Hollywood films, I'm going to get in trouble for saying this, but big blockbuster movies have come from places like this that are fairly controversial. So, I mean, maybe one thing people can do is just be aware or mindful of that. Could you maybe speak about that? And I was also going to say, just be mindful about, you know, avoiding letting your children or having anybody touch or interact with wild animals. If that's something being offered, then you know you're not at a reputable facility.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's consumer demand that drives a lot of this. And while they're you know, should be laws and there should be policies in place that address these concerns, often they're not. But ultimately, they exist because of consumer demand. You know, commercial film shoots or movies or whatever, you know, they have their creative people and they think, hey, let's get a wolf. Hey, let's get a bear. This is going to be a good idea. So there's a demand for this, and we've got to do everything that we can. I think it's incumbent upon people who are concerned about animals to do everything that they can to try to curtail the use of animals in this way. You know, there are all kinds of other ways of having animals in things.
A lot of the best films now. Exactly. Like, I think it was it Dumbo? I can't remember what I went to see recently, but it was all animatronics. Like, you wouldn't even know that they weren't real animals, but there were no actual animals used in the making of the film. So that's something that's much more common. It's interesting because often there'll be exemptions in municipal bylaws for the use of animals for film. And somehow it seems to be a justified use. Like, animals are not allowed into this municipality for circuses anymore, but if it's for the film industry, oh, maybe we can kind of bend the rules on that one. Why is that occurring?
Well, that was or is a relic from the early 1990s when a lot of the problems that we've talked about were still rampant. And that's not to say there's not problems now, because there are, and it's shifted to different kinds of animals. But a lot of those problems were everywhere, both in urban areas and in rural areas. And one of the compromises in developing legislation was to allow for certain kinds of controlled uses of animals at that time. But sensibilities have changed, knowledge has changed. We now know far more than we did back in the early 90s about how animals are used. There's a lot more scrutiny on the industries that supplied animals for certain kinds of uses. And I think the time has come to say, no, let's not allow these kinds of uses anymore. So we're actually engaged, and it's a very slow process of trying to get those things that made some sense back in the 90s, but that make no sense today, to try to get those things off the books.
Is it that some movie studios are able to use animals more responsibly now, these wild animals? Are there cases where you would say it actually is okay that the animals' welfare, you know, concerns are have been, you know, mitigated and it's okay? Or is this just across the board a bad idea?
I think there's the possibility of maybe a small number of anomalous exceptions, but I would say, generally speaking, from everything that I've seen, both in Canada and the United States, it's just a practice that should be stopped. We really don't need it. It's bad for animals. It's potentially dangerous in some circumstances to people, and it should be relegated to the past.
So just to end on, you know, getting back to our initial kind of topic, which is how to kind of tell if a zoo from a sanctuary from a roadside zoo, a few key things to remember is that if you go to a place and you're seeing an animal participate in unnatural behaviors, like being forced to do sort of circus style like tricks or acts, then that's a clue. This is not a great facility. I should speak out about this, or and I shouldn't pay to go into it. If you see that in wild animals, that you're allowed to interact with wild animals, that would be another reason. So basically just to be aware as a zoo visitor that animals, like just to be aware if they're being exploited in those ways or not, in addition to all of the other things we've been talking about. I mean, actually the episode we're airing, the podcast we're airing right before we put this out is going to be our framing episode. So another indicator, as you touched on earlier, is the actual housing of the animals. So last question for you before you go, is framing an indicator that a facility is a slightly higher tier because the really bad roadside zoos can't afford to even do that?
I don't think so, because there are ways that a roadside zoo could very easily frame animals, and I've actually seen it done. I think the level of the framing sophistication rises when you look at, you know, the big professional zoos that have millions of dollars. They have design firms that very carefully figure out exactly how they're going to present animals and what tricks they're going to use to make things look better than they are. So I don't think that's necessarily something that can be used as a metric for determining, you know, the quality of a zoo. What I did want to say, though, is that there's four very simple things that people can look at, and I can say them in just a minute. They can be applied to almost any situation where you see animals in captivity, and that's four things that animals need. Number one, they need space. They need as much space as possible. So if an animal can't or doesn't have enough space to move and behave normally, then that's an indicator. Animals have to have freedom of choice. If they're in barren environments where they don't have an ability to choose what they're going to do, what they're going to eat, who they're going to associate with, that's a sign of a potentially bad situation. Animals need to be in the proper social context. They shouldn't be alone or overcrowded. They need to be in the right social context. And animals need things to do. And I think if anybody who walks into a zoo applies those four things, so space, freedom of choice, social context, and things to do, then I think if they consider those when they're looking at individual cages or enclosure, most of the cages and enclosures, certainly in Canadian zoos, wouldn't pass the mark. So those four things I think anybody can think about, and they can go and apply, and they don't need to be a PhD in ethology or a veterinarian.
Rob, always such a pleasure to talk to you. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much.